If somebody thinks it's a thing of beauty, then it's art.
My guest in the studio tonight has been at the forefront of some of the most innovative music this country has produced, having co-led the internationally acclaimed Clarion Fracture Zone, a member of the Australian Art Orchestra, MARA, and others. Unfairly, in 1997, at the age of 41, his life dramatically changed when he was diagnosed with MS. But despite having his life virtually turned upside down, Tony Gorman has defied the odds, produced the acclaimed album Songs of Hope, co-leads a new project with his wife Sandy Evans called Jest 8, and now releasing As Wide as the Sky with tabla player Bobby Singh. Tony Gorman, welcome.
Good evening. Very nice to be here.
Tony, it's great to have you back. It's been 15 years since we last spoke on air, following an exhilarating impromptu Lust Zone performance.
Wowee, you might, Lust Zone, now that takes me back.
You may have recalled your few brief words there on art.
I wondered where you got that.
Taken from that interview back, I think it must have been, 1992?
Oh my goodness, that's in this room.
At the Bellingen Jazz Festival.
Right, I remember the gig, my goodness. John Clare was dancing.
It was quite a performance, and it certainly made a mark on me, having those two very, very important groups up there.
Do the listeners know the significance of the name Lust Zone?
Wanderlust, of course, Mike Bukowski's Wanderlust gets a good hearing on this program, and of course the Clarion Fracture Zone
Clarion
as well.
Fracture Zone, that was Mike's name. He really liked that name. That was some band.
It was. It was. How many times did you perform that band, by the way?
It wasn't very often, maybe four. Maybe four. There was a special repertoire written. It was just that we played at enough festivals, or we'd be in Sydney together, and it just sort of turned up. We all knew each other so well, and we thought it wouldn't take very much that if we were both at the same gig, that we just write some special tunes, and you know, we're all quick. People used to say about Clarion Fracture Zone, oh my goodness, you guys must rehearse all the time. But in actual fact, sometimes not even the whole band would get together. Everybody was so busy that somebody would write a new tune, and the bass player and the piano player would get together one afternoon, and then 3 weeks later, you know, we'd get the horn parts, you know, in a thermal fax over the phone, you know, and then we'd kind of run it, and then at the gig we'd quickly run it at the sound check, and that very often was the first performance. And Lust Zone was just one step up from that, really. You know, we knew each other well enough that we could write for our strengths, but the collective vibe of the whole thing completely blew us all away. We should have recorded that band. It
would have been fantastic.
Wowie.
Your life and your music, probably everything has changed for you since those days of Clarion Fracture Zone. Can you try and explain how you've adapted to those changes?
Nothing's been the same. It's been 10 years, and I woke up one day and I just couldn't really... I was numb from the waist down. I couldn't walk properly, and just over the next year, I suppose, I had different tests and it showed MS, and nothing has... I suppose it sounds very basic. Nothing's been the same since, and that doesn't mean like when you're really ill and you're wobbling all over the place, or I broke my ankle, I was in a wheelchair, you know, people can really express obvious sympathy for something that's really obvious. But the terrible thing about MS is what they call the hidden symptoms, and so I kind of jokingly refer to it, but it's kind of based in truth. But the trouble now, I've been stable now for quite a while, and that's given me the confidence, like, to release a follow-up to the Songs of Hope and to do it with someone else. My worry all along is involving people is letting them down if I get ill. But actually, it's been a while now, and touch wood, you know, I hope it's a while since till anything else happens. So it's more like the mental scars, you know, you don't trust it. And somebody asked me once, they said, because I take a medicine called Betaferon, which I think is a miracle drug, but it's $20,000 a year if they take it off the
pharmaceutical benefits?
Yes. Yeah. And when I first got ill, it wasn't on the benefit scheme. So, you know, I had the spectre of figuring out how to come up with $20,000 a year when my income had actually stopped altogether, you know. But that has been a miracle drug. But by the time I'd had a few relapses, it was on the scheme. And so I've been taking it for several years now. It's a miracle drug. It's just, but somebody said, oh, and it's giving you certainty. And you go, well, no, it just kind of removes a tiny little bit of doubt. Probably tomorrow I'll be much the same, you know, as I'll be today. But I live a life of depleted energy, strange, you know, sweating fits, strange, you know, you lose the power of astasia or ataxia or something. It's the lack of willpower to get out of chair.
I can recall some of your performances where you'd be playing the alto saxophone and be quite physical with it. You'd be putting your knee in the bell of the saxophone to create different effects.
Yes, yeah.
And obviously now, I mean, that sort of performance on stage just cannot happen, can it?
No, and I had a saxophone quartet, the original Otto Orchestra, and we had a piece that finished with the four saxophones all lifting up their leg, putting it lowers the tone of your bottom note, it takes it down a bit more. And I did my last Otto's gig sitting down, and it was, you can't play the tenor saxophone sitting down, it's just not really an option. It was quite funny, but all the guys, Andrew Robson and Paul Cutland and Boyd, they all joined me, so as the pieces got the fade out at the end and all that, they'd come and sit round my chair and it sort of had the biblical sort of mother and child sort of look about it.
The Srutis, now, is that the correct pronunciation?
It's very hard. I'm Scottish, and I live in a strange place called Curl. It's spelled with a K, two R's and two L's, So I'm not quite sure if Shruti is, in fact, the correct pronunciation as far as Indians are concerned, but near enough.
Tell us what they are, actually.
Well, the Shruti box is an electronic tanpura, and it's an Indian instrument, and the tanpura is the string instrument that's at the back of the stage when you have a solo singer or a flute player, and just keeps that.
Is it a drone?
A twangy drone, but it's not it's not a sitar. You don't play it like you don't play lines. You just have these open, and that just keeps this sort of a musical incense going. And so they have this. They have these electronic ones now, and I started off. It's a very Mark One version I've got. The Indians, they don't even manufacture them anymore, as far as I know. And it's basically like an analog synthesizer, and it's got four notes on it. And so at the performance, this CD is a live performance from Birdland Records, and basically I start with just a solo clarinet, and then I bring in one note, and then I play for a while with one note, and then I bring in a second note, and I play for a while with the two notes, and I just sort of point out the changing relationships. I used to explain to the audience, though, but when I just close my eyes and play the clarinet, I'm just in the universe, just floating along, no reference points of any description, and then you add one note, and it's just like one light bulb, and you still don't get perspective of the size of the whole room, but you've got like a moth around a light or something,
a reference point.
You've just got one reference point, and then you add two notes, and it's like a straight line then, and then you add a third note, and slowly you fill in the spaces and make your own space. And I go to some fairly, and it's very, very soft and gentle, but I think I go to some pretty out there places occasionally. And then my sound engineer the other night, Bobby and I have been doing a couple of gigs, he couldn't believe it. It was a physical effect. Literally the hairs in the back of his neck, there was a certain note I went to, and until I moved off this note, the hairs in the back of his neck just stood up spontaneously.
Really?
I was very touched. And so I build up the Shruti's until there's eight notes in, and it's like a big... And by then, it's kind of bliss out music. And so by then, you've forgotten the fact that it's like a 1963 transistor radio that's playing. You'd never imagine. And I've created a whole universe, like a puppet show, really, or something.
This particular performance, the whole thing recorded live at Birdland Records in one of their in-store performances, it's one long track, isn't it?
Yes.
That's why there's got to be some sort of punctuation in there to go from one track. And what you were saying, that each reference point basically starts a new
I thought track. Of it a bit like a recitative, in an opera, when the actual performance doesn't stop, but for the sake of buying the CD, you can't just have track one, and that's Wagner.
Yeah.
The first act is all just track one that's in. And it's just quite hard. But what was hard about this piece is because there's these drones go between the pieces, and it was just very hard to decide how much of an intro to give. Just for the number eight to come on, should it actually be immediately I stop playing or immediately Bobby starts? Or
you must have been almost tempted to have one track.
That's what we started with. There would have been two tracks, actually. There's a first and a second set.
Right.
And the second set's like the last track. It's called Love Sanctuary, and it's 13 minutes. What I normally say to the audience is we're going to tune up now. And at some point the tuning stops and the music starts. I mean, we've never really picked, that moment, where the crossover happens. And the Shrutis, I didn't introduce the Shrutis when I first started playing with Bobby, because he's Indian, and I didn't want to introduce an Indian influence, because I'm not Indian and I don't play, although it's inspired by music from many places, I don't play Indian music. So it was only when I'd played with Bobby for quite a while that I suddenly went, let's do it with the Shrutis. And he now knows me well enough to know that, his girlfriend came in and said, oh, and how do you tune the Shruti? And they just went, look, don't bother, dear. Just don't bother. You wouldn't understand. And it's not insulting or anything. I don't mean to trample all over cultures, but the less I know, the better.
Earlier this morning, I was just downstairs and I was listening to the radio, which was going on upstairs, and just listening to it in the background, I heard this clarinet on the radio. It was Radio National, I must admit. And I said to myself, that's Tony Gorman. And anyway, I just kept on working. I kept on working and was moving towards the end of the track. And I raced upstairs and, of course, it was Tony Gorman. It was taken from your album Songs of Hope, which I must add that I haven't even got and probably have never heard from start to finish. But I could hear your sound. Now, when did you realise that you did have your own sound?
Oh, I was very fortunate. I was very fortunate that when I left school, I went to the Royal Scottish Academy of Music. My teacher was Janet Hilton. She was young at the time, and I was her first ever student, her first study student. She's now the head of wind teaching at the Royal College of Music in London. She's like a venerable old lady now, you know, but when I was 17, she was probably 26 or something, and she made me sit in a room, you know. But I say this, I use this phrase a lot now with my own students, you know, and I'll say to them, oh, you were obviously the best player in your school, you see. So I went to college and I was the best player in my school. And when I realised what the standard actually was, you know, it was fairly sobering, to say the least. And Janet made me basically sit in a room for about 6 months and just play long notes, just starting from nothing and just building up as loud as you can possibly go and just going down to nothing again. And I wasn't allowed to put two notes together. I just had to do one note and then just stop and then think about it and then do the next note and then blah, blah, blah. And I had one other exercise that I did. It was also a breathing thing. And at the end of, I don't know, the middle of my second year at college, suddenly my F in the middle register of the clarinet went boom, and it had a bell-like quality that hadn't been there before. And instead of struggling with this agony stick, you know, suddenly the door opened and I got this phenomenal depth of sound. And suddenly when the door opens like that, you can play with it, you know. And I took that to my first instrument was the alto sax, and I took just the discipline of the long note thing, really. To all my instruments, I've always had a great sound, you know. If I say so myself, everyone told me, you know, the neighbours used to, you know, all my practising, you know, when you live in a tenement in Glasgow and you've about 400 people can hear you practising, you know, but people would stop me in the street and was like, you practising? Oh, that's great, you know. But you were still really self-conscious because my sound was huge, you know. So at the age of 41, I was 17 when that started, and at the age of, and I always played like that, and I always, and I write tunes with phenomenally long phrases, and it's quite funny, everyone thinks the music sounds easy, like Clary Frax's songs, my songs are simple, you know, the Spice Island, and I saw you had Blue Shift there earlier, the other one, Mo Shoo Shoo, and it's when you go to play it, it's I want you to hold those last note, those long notes, you know, at the end of the tune to the end of the bar, so you've got to hold this double 40 long note for like 32 bars, so I was always, I didn't do it as a martial art, but it gives you, it's like being a 5-litre V8, you know, in any situation. And people sometimes thought, they would go, why do you play so loud? And you say, you don't point out that I'm also twice as quiet as you. And I could actually go as quiet as you wanted or as loud as you wanted. I was never left behind and I was never overpowering unless I wanted to be, you know. And when I got ill, my hands are numb, almost completely. I feel like I'm wearing, when I put my hands in my pocket, it feels like you're putting them into a spider's web, like that. You're fumbling for keys. You can't discern the handkerchief from a coin. And so the instrument, it was murder. So I can't play quickly anymore. And I thought, what can I actually, you know, do? Because I still felt like a musician, you know. And I wasn't ready to sit in a room and be a writer. I've never felt like a natural writer. My wife, Sandy, she's a natural writer. She can close the door for 6 months. And I admire authors for that. They can just get up in the morning, 2,000 words a day, no worries. And I get lonely, you know. I'm sort of lonely doing that. And get fed up. So for me, a piece tends to fester in my head for months, and then suddenly one day I go, oh, I better write that down, and I write down something for the art orchestra, you know. It just takes me a week. But I thought, what can I do? Well, I can talk and I can play long notes.
Tony, from an outsider's perspective, yours is a story of great courage, really. You trust in yourself and conviction. How would you describe how you've coped?
I was only 41, and I reckon I was 38 years old when I thought, you know, it's working. I've done it. You know, it's very hard to be a musician. And I just felt like there was enough momentum. You know, Sandy and I, we'd bought a little property and we'd had a car we liked and, you know, everything like that. And
Clarion so, was touring internationally?
Several times. We did that the year of the first album, in fact, what, 89 we recorded. Got the 90 ARIA. We toured, we were the second band, I think, after John McLaughlin to go to the Soviet Union after the fall of Russia in 1990. We were in Lithuania and the tanks were still there. They'd switched off the hot water. So, that you know, Clarion toured regularly. And then when I joined the Mara band, between the two bands, it's both. Very, I mean, Mara's pretty well known all over the place, and yes, it was great, and I loved it all. There wasn't anything I didn't do any work. And then when I got ill, you really had to confront. You know, had I done enough? I wasn't ready to. You know, I don't know how to describe it. It was a huge vortex, anyway. The thing, and it brought up all kinds of things, and anything unresolved was brought to the surface. And at that time, I had a mythical table, you know, and this went on for a long time. There was a long period, because my hands were numb. You didn't have a period when you woke up in the morning of reflection. There was no, you just couldn't relax ever, you know, and I'm still at this now, you know. I spend half my time standing and half my time sitting down. You know, I wake up in the middle of the night, I've just got to stand up just for a minute, you know, just because I've got to, I can only do 4 or 5 hours of one or the other, you know. Yeah, like, yeah. And I cycle. When Sandy and I did the MS cycle run to Wollongong last year, you know, okay. That was a big ambition. For my 50th birthday, I got a new bicycle and we went out practicing. But I had to get rid of a lot of unwanted emotions. I had this table. Every morning I got up and I sort of have a quick cry, because as soon as you touch the covers, the second you woke up, you knew you didn't feel anything, you know.
Yep.
And so you're just instantly awake. And I used to dream I was buried in sand because you couldn't move your legs. It's just the nerves. It's your nerves, you know. As soon as you were awake, you could move your legs. There was no problem. But just in that half state, the connections weren't getting through, and you'd lie there and I'd have dreams of, you know, being buried in snowdrifts or sand walls collapsing on you. Oh, I can't move my legs. And that was really tough. You just had to find a way to deal with it. So I had my table and I put all my emotions out every day. And I tried just to take back the ones that I wanted, the positive ones, the strong, the brave. My aim is to live forever. So far, so good.
You say on your website, which is the www.myspace.com/Tony Gorman, you write, from the first time we played together, it was like hand in glove. Now, this was reference to Bobby Singh.
Yeah.
And you also go on to say, I've never had to say anything to him other than let's play. How often does this kind of pure symmetry occur in a career that's lasted 35 years?
With somebody that you don't really know very well, almost never. It's those things tend to happen I don't know, it's like falling in love or something, you know. It's you can choose your ideal band and maybe none of you get on, you know. It's like there used to be a jazz series on television, and it was this American series, and you could see the thinking, you know. Larry Coryell's a great guitarist, and so-and-so, you know, I can't think of all the names now, Philip Catherine, I think, was on it. Let's get 10 of them. And they'd get a band together, and they'd actually have 10 really famous guitarists all just soloing one after the other.
It didn't work,
you know.
Didn't work.
And so I've never really, I've had many lovely offers of people, good friends, you know, can I play and help you and things like that. And it's never felt right. And the person would be right, but the music wasn't right. But Bobby came up because I was at Wangaratta and I was watching Dave Liebman. I was watching Dave Liebman play with an Irish trio, and it was 12 o'clock lunchtime, and he, you know, he does pretty challenging music, and it's the John Coltrane thing where he needs that wall of noise from the drums so that he can sit above it and sort of it's so busy that you can rest almost. It's some And it wasn't happening, you know, and you'd really heard Dave Liebman doing all the work, and he was playing fast, but the other guys were struggling. And then suddenly the drummer just kind of woke up, and it was almost like you double your tempo then, your natural rhythm. It becomes Stirling Moss famously said he only found serenity in speed, and it was only when you were concentrating 100% and not making a mistake that you actually found peace. And I think playing is like that, you know. It's only when you're 100% committed, and I'm watching this drummer suddenly get 100%. 100% committed, and I went, the tabla, because it's not an overwhelming instrument, but it's a beautiful, it can be as busy as rain on a thing, or it can be the thunder as well. It can be, you know, I suddenly imagined a sort of mosaic carpet, I don't know how it phrases, but it was just so busy that it actually becomes slow again. It becomes like a, you know, just a drip outside your bedroom window from the gutter is really annoying, but Niagara Falls is a really, you know,
it's peaceful.
And it's just worked, you know, and I used to go and visit Bobby, and I was very nervous. I hadn't played with anyone for ages, and it took me ages to kind of set up my hands and numb, as I say, and it takes me ages to tune up. And of course, Indian musicians are used to just sitting there. But when the shooty box I got was from Karakudi Armani, who played with the Art Orchestra, a famous Indian musician, and it didn't matter what the programme was. You know, at the rehearsals I'm talking about, maybe you'd have 2 days rehearsal, and his piece was at 5 o'clock, but the band was starting at 9:30. Well, he was there at 9:30. He was set up ready to go at 9:30, because it's a sign of respect. And he sat there all morning, and then came for lunch with us, and then sat there all afternoon, and then his piece was at 5 o'clock. And the Western musicians aren't like that. They're not required till 5 o'clock. They don't turn up till 5 o'clock, you know. And so yeah. Bobby's like that. He's a very beautiful man. And then when he's done the patient waiting for me to get ready, he would just do this beautiful, you mean this kind of thing. And one day he said to me, you know, as wide as the sky, I decided to do 4 instead of 3. And I went, oh, I never even noticed. And it's like we don't even sort of, at its best, we don't listen to each other. And it has its own natural, completely unique form. Every performance is a completely unique form that sounds like that. It's beautiful. It's a wonderful way to work.
The medical fraternity have recently come up with a new term for laziness, and it's called motivational deficiency syndrome, MDS. Having suffered MS now for over a decade, what's your reason for getting up in the morning?
I want to play the clarinet. The air is fresh at that time of the morning. I don't do late night club gigs anymore, and I wake up at dawn. And for maybe 3 of those years, I taught myself the classical guitar from 5:30 to 9 in the morning every day for about 3 years, just to get the fingers working. Reading. I've fallen off the tree with the writing. I used to write a lot more, but I'm very clumsy with the fingers, and I've lost the pleasure. But I used to. That was when the first thing I did when I got ill, actually, was not knowing whether I'd ever play again. I enrolled at the Warringah Community College, and I did a writing course with Lynn Atkins, and I'm very happy we did this course. It was great. I really liked it. She helped me a lot. A thing called a brain drain. You get up in the morning and don't read the paper and don't put on the radio, and actually you don't even need to look at it while you write. You actually just write everything that's in your head at the moment, all the clutter that you think, and then you just screw it up and throw it away, and now you can start writing. And it's a really good thing. You sort of empty the dustbin, and that helped a lot. I don't think she had any idea at the time that it helped, because I was still a rather full-on, extremely flamboyant artist with Sandy used to ask me if I wasn't too happy, but when I got ill, I was desperate to be hopeful, you know. And then the reason to get up in the morning wore off, and I had to dig a bit deeper. So I can't give you one actual reason, but I don't dread waking up anymore.
Music is still at the core of your life.
I'm absolutely, since, I'd be dead by now if I hadn't discovered the saxophone. I was a late starter, I was 15, and until that point I was, every year I was declared like an F, completely unmusical at school because I wouldn't join the school choir. And when I got my alto sax, I immediately... But my dad's a musician, and so I was surrounded by music, but I didn't play anything. And when I got my alto sax, I very quickly became really quite good at it. And then you couldn't do the O level it is in Scotland, but not the HSC, but the one, just the school certificate, the one you do at 15. I couldn't do that on a saxophone, so I had to do an orchestral instrument. So I had about, I think, 4 or 5 months that I took up the clarinet, learned the repertoire, did my O-level music, you know, and so I sort of, just starting at the age of 15, it was just a constantly ever-widening sort of funnel that went up, and I took in, and I was a rock musician, because you've got to be in Scotland at the age of 17 or you don't work. But it's a bit like Ireland, where you've got these, like, show bands, you know, where you get bands that do Scottish country dancing, then a bit of the tops, you know, the top of the pops, top 70, and then a bit of Glenn Miller, and then a bit of, you know, and it's, and you just got to turn your hand to absolutely anything, a bit of folk music, and then this Uncle Johnny gets up and wants to sing such and such, and it just taught me so much, you know, about, and a few people taught me so much about never denying music, you know, and I developed a phrase over the years which I just love, but the music doesn't care, you know, the people that tell you, oh, don't listen to that rubbish, or don't listen to that rubbish, it's the music, it doesn't give a stuff. actually. It's only people that say, "Oh, that's not music." Well, the music doesn't think so.
Tony Gorman, thanks very much for joining me in the studio tonight.
Thank you very much, Frank. It's been great.